This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Well, the facts just keep mounting in the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Now, a Utah restaurant owner claims the alleged shooter, Tyler Robinson, was hungry. Yeah. Shooting Charlie Kirk, husband and father, activist, certainly did not dampen his appetite. The restaurant owner, even revealing what the alleged assassin ordered. Wow, how do people do it? I've always been curious. How do they manage to wolf down a steak dinner after gunning somebody down dead? I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us. That's right, a Utah business owner says Tyler Robinson wolfed down a steak dinner after allegedly gunning down conservative activist Charlie Kirk. And it wasn't just a steak dinner. It was a hearty steak dinner. It was a mom-and-pop steakhouse about 3 hours south of where the Turning Point USA founder was shot at an Orem College gathering. The 22-year-old murder suspect sat all alone at the counter, kept to himself, but ate like a pig. That's what we're learning. Okay, reality check. Enough about the steak dinner. What about Charlie Kirk? What happened that day?
Charlie Kirk, the 31-year-old head of Turning Point USA, is shot dead during a speaking event at Utah Valley University in Orem. The shooting took place about 20 minutes into his speech. Bystanders said Kirk was hit in the neck while answering student questions. A UVU alert confirmed, quote, a single shot was fired on campus toward a visiting speaker. Police are investigating now. Video from the scene showed students running as the shots rang out and Kirk being rushed away by his security team. Utah Governor Spencer Cox posted on X, quote, those responsible will be held fully accountable. Violence has no place in our public life. Americans of every political persuasion must unite in condemning this act. Our prayers are with Charlie, his family, and all those affected. Utah Senator Mike Lee wrote, quote, please join me in praying for Charlie Kirk and the students gathered there. Vice President Vance added on X, quote, say a prayer for Charlie Kirk, a genuinely good guy and a young father. FBI Director Kash Patel said, quote, we are closely monitoring reports of the tragic shooting involving Charlie Kirk at Utah Valley University. Our thoughts are with Charlie, his loved ones, and everyone involved. Agents will be on the scene quickly, and the FBI stands in full support of the ongoing response. Kirk himself had posted online only moments before the attack, quote, we are so back. Utah Valley University is fired up and ready for the first stop on the American Comeback Tour. Charlie Kirk rose to national prominence after co-founding Turning Point USA in 2012. He has since built the group into a major conservative force on campuses, created several offshoots, including Turning Point Action and Turning Point Faith, and he hosts the Charlie Kirk Show. He has been a strong supporter of President Trump and has often spoken out on issues like critical race theory and government mandates. On Wednesday, he was speaking under a tent at the university courtyard as part of his American Comeback Tour. Shots were fired from the top of a nearby building about 200 yards away. The campus went into lockdown while police and federal agents swarmed the scene. Earlier reports stated a shooter was arrested, but that has been corrected by UVU to state that there is no suspect in custody.
With a high degree of certainty, we have him.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We got him.
A massive manhunt.
The suspect was taken into custody at 10 p.m. local time.
The assassin who gunned down a loving father of two, a husband.
The suspect was apprehended in a historic time period.
In custody.
The assassin who guns down a father of two.
He is observed on video in a plain maroon t-shirt, light-colored shorts, a black hat with a white logo, and light-colored shoes. Arriving on UVU campus in a gray Dodge Challenger at approximately 8:29 a.m., Tyler Robinson had become more political in recent years. A second unfired casing read, Oh, Bella Chow, and a third unfired casing read, If you read this, you are gay.
His wife and two little children who will grow up without daddy.
This is a very sad day for our country.
And I do know this is going to be a federal case, and there's many of us believe that Charlie was targeted because of his political ideology.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to this guy?
Well, I hope he was going to be found guilty, I would imagine, and I hope he gets the death penalty.
Tyler James Robinson, count one, aggravated murder. Count two, felony discharge of a firearm causing serious bodily injury. I am filing a notice of intent to seek the death penalty. The defendant is believed to have targeted Charlie Kirk based on Charlie Kirk's political expression, and did so knowing that children were present and would witness the homicide.
Death penalty is the death penalty is the death penalty. They loaded him up. That's right. With so many alternative counts, it will be hard for a jury to find him not guilty. Listen.
I am filing a criminal information charging Tyler James Robinson, age 22, with the following crimes. Count one, aggravated murder, a capital offense. For intentionally or knowingly causing the death of Charlie Kirk under circumstances that created a grave risk of death to others. Count two, felony discharge of a firearm causing serious bodily injury, a first degree felony.
Legal term, they ain't playing. Joining me, an all-star panel to make sense of what we are learning in the courtroom, straight out to Randolph Rice joining us, former felony prosecutor, now criminal defense attorney, joining us at Rice Law. Randolph Rice, charging in the alternative. I've done it a million times. If I got a case and the grand jury had not indicted in the alternative, I would either A, send it back to the grand jury and represent it myself to get those alternative counts, or have the judge charge the jury with the alternative counts. What I mean by that is, you shoot Jackie. You plan to shoot Jackie. It's malice aforethought. It's premeditated murder. Murder one. So I charge you with murder one, but I'm worried. So then I charge you with voluntary manslaughter, murder two, involuntary manslaughter if I'm desperate. In other words, there is no way you are walking out of that courtroom, if I have anything to do with it, without a conviction. They loaded him up. Explain in a nutshell, Rice, nutshell.
Well, Nancy, you did a great job of explaining that, because if you don't get that top count, that most serious count, you've got the backups. But the problem here is, and there is a problem, is that I think that they may be reaching on this aggravated murder. Now, they may be using this as leverage to force him or try to get him to take a plea. But the aggravating circumstances at this point, I think, are very, very thin.
Head blowing off. Are you? They're reaching. Are you serious? This guy, according to the state, this guy stakes out the place, and I believe they're going to end up with video showing that was not his first trip to the top of that roof. He stakes it out. He plans it in advance, even a wardrobe change. A lot of forethought goes into this. He targets someone because of their freedom of speech. I don't care if you agree with Kirk or disagree with Kirk. I really couldn't care less. Doesn't matter. He targeted him for his freedom of speech. And that is a major, major aggravating circumstance. It's akin to shooting a judge or shooting a political figure like the president or the vice president or shooting a prosecutor or shooting a cop. You go after them because of what they represent that you don't like. And you actually, you know what? You really know how to kick it off wrong, don't you? I bet you're a super downer at a party. You come in to Crime Stories and blurt out the state is reaching. What could be more aggravating?
Well, Nancy, the problem is that they're trying to rely on the fact that there were children present or that the crime could have hurt somebody else. And again, that seems to be a bit of a stretch for
them. Show him the crowd. Yeah, there you go. Look at that. He shot from a little under 200 yards away, and you're saying nobody else was in danger, Rice? Look at your monitor.
Nobody else is in danger in this situation, at least from, again, I'm arguing the defense here. And I think that the state has a good argument, but in the defense's argument, they're going to say this was a single bullet that had a single target that ultimately killed Charlie Kirk, and it didn't endanger the other people in the crowd. And that's where there may be a problem for the prosecutor's office in trying to seek the charge that seeks the death penalty.
Okay, so Randolph, you come in, you plop down in the studio, and you first say the state is reaching. They can't prove it. Did I not hear you just say the state has a good argument? So which one is it? Does the state have a good argument? I say they do. Or are they overreaching? You know, that's a very sad second verse, same as the first. Is there any defense attorney that doesn't say in a murder case you're overreaching?
Oh, no. Every single case, every defense attorney says that you're overreaching. I do it in all the cases that I defend because that's their job. Their job is to challenge the prosecution to say, did you try to get too much here? And again, this is a tactic that the prosecution is using to try to get the defendant to take a plea, saying, hey, look.
Did you actually say the P word, plea? You think there's going to be a plea? You think they're going to pull a Koberger with the whole world watching them? You don't think they're going to take this to trial and seek the death penalty, whether they get it or not?
I thought Koberger was going to go to trial, and look what happened there. I think that this is something they're trying to push him into, is to take a plea.
Okay, you know what? That's the first thing you've said so far to me, Randolph Rice, that makes any sense. But actually, now that I think about it, you're absolutely correct. The number of counts could be a tactic to make the defendant plead guilty because there seems to be no way out with all these alternative counts. I don't see it happening, though. I don't see a plea going down in this case. But again, you're right. We didn't see one coming in Koberger either. But put him up one more time. Randolph, guys, let me remind you, Rice is a former very successful felony prosecutor. He's won a lot of cases. Now he is a criminal defense attorney, civil attorney. So, Randolph, the aggravating circumstance you mentioned was just that other people were endangered. It's not like you shoot Jackie in the studio and it's just the two of you. This is a shooting with a throng of people, thousands of people. If that bullet had gone the wrong way, if there had been a gust of wind, who knows? But they included another aggravating circumstance, that this murder occurred in the presence of children. Now, that is aggravating. A violent felony that occurs in the presence of children. How are you going to get out of that, Randolph Rice?
Bring a child in there that actually saw the murder. They're going to have to prove that in court, that a child actually saw it, was affected by it, and therefore that's the aggravating circumstance. And so I don't know if they've got that right now. It just might be tough for them on that count.
Okay, you're right. That's an element of proof. They will have to bring in a child witness to prove it. Guys, a lot has happened since these charges were announced formally in court. Now, what that was an arraignment. An arraignment where the defendant is brought in because you cannot stay behind bars over 72 hours without being told what you're charged with by typically a magistrate. I believe this is going to be the trial judge from here out. But we're also learning not just the charges, but how the murder went down. Listen.
At approximately 11:51 a.m., the suspect entered campus from the north. He is seen wearing a black shirt with an American flag in the center, a dark baseball cap, and large sunglasses. Throughout the surveillance, the suspect keeps his head down and rarely raises his head enough to get a clear image of his face. As he proceeds across the campus, he is seen walking with an unusual gait. The suspect walks with very little bending in his right leg, consistent with a rifle being hidden in his pants.
Joining us now, Hermania Rodriguez. She's the chief U.S. reporter, Daily Mail. Hermania, thank you for being with us. So that explains, hey, let's see that TMZ video we have of him walking, because I can see what the prosecution is talking about, especially if they play this in promo. Hermania, explain what they're talking about.
Right. So officials gave us more insight about the hours before this shooting last week. As we can see on the screen, the suspect was seen arriving on campus about 4 hours before the shooting, and there he is limping. Now, this made the public wonder why this person was limping. Do they have a limp? Yesterday, we learned that actually he had hidden the rifle that he used in one of his pant legs, and that's why he's limping the way we see him on screen.
You know, he's kind of bold. What about it? Chris McDonough joining us, director Cold Case Foundation, former homicide detective, star of The Interview Room on YouTube, who has gone to this scene, to the home, to the shooting scene, through the neighborhood. You know, that's pretty bold. Has he not heard of Ring doorbell cams? Because they catch him, you know, going door to door to door to door. They've got almost an uninterrupted path of him walking through the neighborhood. And don't tell me, McDonough, he didn't case this out like, where am I going to park? How am I going to get away? This has been at least days in the making.
Absolutely, Nancy. And what I've learned is he did have that vehicle up there, and it was parked about a mile away from the crime scene, and he walked in to the crime scene to case it out initially before the situation went down. And then later, I've also learned that he turned his phone off for a short period of time and then turned it back on after the homicide.
Chris McDonough, speaking of walking through the neighborhood to his vehicle, where did he park his muscle car?
The muscle car, Nancy, was parked approximately a mile away at a church parking lot, an LDS church parking lot.
Joe Scott Morgan joining me, professor of forensics, Jacksonville State University, author of Blood Beneath My Feet on Amazon, and star of a hit new podcast series, Body Bags with Joe Scott Morgan. Joe Scott, really? Did he pull a Koberger / Morphew where they both think they've outsmarted everybody by turning their phone off there? It's like my teen children. They're 17, believe it or not. The phone is constantly on, even right down to 0.1%. Okay. They will not turn it off, even when they charge it. See, that is a pattern or practice. So when you just coincidentally turn your phone off, at the time of the incident, I mean, think about it, Joe Scott. If it weren't for the murder, the MO, modus operandi method of operation, would be laughable. Because you see the pings leading up to a certain spot, and then, poof, the phone goes off. The murder occurs. Then, poof, the phone goes back on, and you see the return back to your home nest. Right? It's just...
Yeah, you're right. And welcome to the real world here, because these phones are the modern crime scene. Because it seems like every case that we cover, you know, I think most famously to this point, Koberger's case, you go to these patterns of behavior. This was spoken about quite a bit in that particular case. We have established patterns. Why are you going to turn it off at this particular time? And look, the case is not proven simply based on that, but it's another element that can be integrated into this from a behavioral standpoint.
This video from our friends over at The Independent. Speaking of the rifle, listen.
The rifle, ammunition rounds, and towel were sent for forensic processing. DNA consistent with defendant was found on the trigger, other parts of the rifle, the fired cartridge casing, two of the three unfired cartridges, and the towel. Law enforcement was unable to immediately locate the shooter, so they published photos of the shooter from the UVU surveillance cameras and asked for the public's help to identify him. Meanwhile, law enforcement continued to try to identify the shooter through other means.
Joining us, Dr. Bethany Marshall, renowned psychoanalyst out of the L.A. jurisdiction. She is the author of Deal Breaker. You can see her now on Peacock. And she's at drbethanymarshall.com. Before you launch into the whole furry connection, I want to hear your thoughts on a guy that comes from a loving home, very loving. We've heard, wow, he was afraid to tell his parents he was dating another guy that was transitioning. The family knew. I'm going to tell you about that in just a moment. So he comes from a very loving home. He was smart. Dr. Bethany Marshall got a scholarship at the top 1% of, I believe it was his ACT exam, almost $40,000 of scholarship. Goes to college, doesn't like it, leaves college, comes out, pursues... Ooh, listen to this.
$32,000. This scholarship is available for 4 years or 8 semesters.
Woo!
I mean, they're supportive. They love him. But my bottom line here is, what went wrong? And I'm not talking about his relationship with a guy. That's irrelevant. Doesn't matter. Some people say right. Some people say wrong. Don't care. But what I'm talking about, Bethany, is how do you go from a loving home where the parents like you're the apple of their eye to becoming a psycho cheater?
Because, Nancy, he seems to me to be what we call narcissistically vulnerable, meaning he gets the $32,000 scholarship, but then he drops out of college and studies to become an electrician. And what that tells me, if he were my patient, is that he cannot tolerate being with his peers. He doesn't feel intact or good enough about himself. He doesn't have a strong ego. So the risk factor for shooters is that they often feel insulted by society. They feel that they are in a one-down position, that everybody's bullying them, everybody's acting like they're better than them, and they hold on to every little grudge until they have some kind of a profound loss in their life. And in this case, it may have been dropping out of college, and they become even angrier. And when they decide to shoot, they don't just walk through the crowd, Nancy. They're always on the top of a building. Have you noticed that about school shooters? I mean, one we covered many years ago was a guy who stood at the top of a staircase after having locked all the doors so the students couldn't get out. We call it like the fish in a barrel kind of MO of the shooting. So that's the reversing of the feeling of being powerless. Now he's in a powerful position. He's like the big man on campus, literally whizzing bullets over children and families' heads, talking about getting an erection, which is inscribed on the bullet, and feeling powerful for the first time in his life. So he's trying to reverse a feeling of being powerless, helpless, and at the bottom of society.
To receive the resident presidential scholarship from Utah State University. The value of this scholarship is approximately $32,000. This scholarship is available for 4 years or 8 semesters.
He is seen wearing a black shirt with an American flag in the center, a dark baseball cap, and large sunglasses.
He arrived on campus in different clothing, changed into what we see in those surveillance images, then changed back into the other outfit.
He shoots, and then he's off the building.
He is seen walking with an unusual gait.
Then we see him limping as he's walking through.
He had a conscious objective.
Formal charges read in open court, but I'm more interested. Those charges, in my mind, were predictable, although the state did get creative in the aggravating circumstances that they charged. It's not just murder. It's aggravated murder, murder with, quote, aggravating circumstances. And the significance of that, in order to seek the death penalty, you have to include aggravating circumstances. Just murdering somebody is not enough. Now, there has to be aggravating circumstances. And to Randolph Rice, joining us, veteran trial lawyer, they vary, but in every jurisdiction across our country, you have to have aggravating circumstances to seek the death penalty. In Coburger, it was mass murder. More than one body, it's mass murder. Here, explain the significance of them putting in the indictment, in the charges, the aggravating circumstances. They have to be proved just like every element of the crime.
Nancy, you're exactly right. You've got to prove every single element, because what happens is the jurors are going to get a jury instruction at some point in time, and it's going to have all these different elements. And it's going to say, unless you find beyond a reasonable doubt that every single element has been met, then you can't find him guilty of that charge. And so there is the issue with, does the state meet these aggravating circumstances that gets them to the conviction, that gets them to the death penalty?
So, for instance, in every prosecution, and we'll just go with murder since that's what we're talking about tonight, you have to prove who is the victim, that the indictment has the victim correct. You have to prove the jurisdiction. You have to prove malice aforethought, even if it's malice that lasts for a moment. The twinkling of an instant, the blink of an eye qualifies as time to prove intent. But when you seek the death penalty, you have to include these aggravating circumstances, and then they become an element of proof. You have to prove them, each element, beyond a reasonable doubt. Like you said earlier correctly, they may have to bring in a child to prove a child was in harm's way. So we'll see how the state's going to prove it.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Apparently, the woman that serves Robinson said he was quiet and shy, but according to police, he was bold enough to pull off an assassination, taking an extremely difficult shot and gunning down a father and husband. So he turns up 3 hours away, chowing down. The scene that he had just left. Horrific. What happened?
On September 11, 2025, the day after the shooting, Robinson's mother saw the photo of the shooter in the news and thought the shooter looked like her son. Robinson's mother called her son and asked him where he was. He said he was at home sick, and that he had also been at homesick on September 10th.
Hold on just a moment. Hermania Rodriguez joining us, Daily Mail. He said he was homesick. What, did he add the dog ate my homework? Homesick. That's weak.
These were details that, I mean, were really harrowing if you imagine what these parents went through. As we just saw officials saying, apparently the day after the shooting, this mother looks at the images released by the FBI as they were hunting this person down. She thinks it looks like her son, calls him. He says he's at home sick for the second day in a row.
Yeah, you know what? Joe Scott Morgan, what about it? If I saw my son or daughter in a baseball hat and a pair of sunglasses, I would still know it's them.
Of course you would. Yeah, all of us would. There's no way that you're not going to recognize your child. I think the big thing here, you know, probably for this mother, and this is more of a Dr. Bethany issue, but what do you do with that information? You know, how does it, because you've been with him his entire life. So, you know, again, she's going to call him up. She wants to confirm it. You know, do I believe my lying eyes? And it turns out that her eyes were not lying in this case, Nancy.
You know what? You're right. Dr. Bethany Marshall, how will this affect the parents going forward, knowing they turned their son in?
You know, Joe Scott Morgan and I were talking on the break, and that sound where he has the $32,000 scholarship, do you notice that his affect is very flat? He doesn't seem excited.
Yes, I did.
So it's the mother that goes, woo, and then he kind of mimics the woo in a less sharp tone or less elevated tone. So I'm going to guess that this mother has a long history of trying to pump her son up to act normal in society. So when she sees this image of him, I don't think it's as much of a shock as you and I might think. I would guess, you know how parents know their children, that they've always known something is wrong and they're always waiting for the other shoe to drop. She sees the image, it's confirmed. She calls dad. Reality meets internal fearfulness. And now she's the one who has to turn him in. Maternal guilt, Nancy. She's going to feel maternal guilt, not only that she turned him in, but that she gave birth to somebody who could have done this, and she'll blame herself for having raised him in the wrong way, although we know these kinds of disorders are very biologically based. It is not the parents' fault.
Okay, I understood about 50% of what you said. Okay, I think what you said is the mother has likely spent her whole life trying to present to the world and to herself that her son is normal. And I don't mean that he's mentally insane, because he clearly knew what he did was wrong. He planned it. He concealed it. Then he covered it up afterwards. That's evidence of guilty conscience. He knew it was wrong. But mom compensating, saying, look, he won a scholarship. He's so smart. Look, this, he, you know, is a Boy Scout. Look, he sings in the choir. He's awesome. He cuts the grass. I love him. He's wonderful. All the while knowing something is off, that's a lifetime of compensating, Dr. Bethany.
Yes, this mother has her own lifetime sentence. And I obviously I haven't met this guy. I don't know if he's a sociopath, but let's say theoretically if he was, the mother would likely have noticed many things.
Look, Bethany, look at your screen.
Oh.
I grew up on a red dirt road, as everybody knows. And I always wonder, I look at people with like a 6-bedroom home worth over $500,000. They're all going to college. They have great jobs. What's not to be happy about? I don't get it, Dr. Bethany. Maybe I've set the standard too low. But, you know, I got a family. I've got a home. I've got a job. For right now, we're all healthy. I'm on top of the world. I don't get it, Bethany.
But we know that this guy was supremely unhappy. He was so unhappy, he couldn't even follow through with a scholarship. So unhappy that he can't even smile when he gets the scholarship. Nancy, this has nothing to do with his upbringing or his family. I can say that fairly confidently, even without knowing them. This type of disorder is what we call psychobiological, meaning, to break it down, there's something wrong with his brain. If you did a brain scan, you would probably see that there's a quieting in the part of the brain that's responsible for empathy. You might even see like a Koberger syndrome of bullying other people and wanting to be in a one-up position.
Okay, no. I'm not going to let you go down the Aaron Hernandez route where they claim, the defense claims, he murdered so many people because there was something wrong with his brain when he functioned completely normally and excelled, was a multimillionaire, blew it. No.
But Nancy, this
guy
was
not going to be a defense.
This guy was not functioning normally. He was on top of that building, sweating, depositing all this DNA in the text. We read that he wants to take the secret with him till old age. So he actually thinks he's going to get away with this. That is something seriously wrong with him.
Randolph Rice, please get her back in the middle of the road and out of the weeds. All criminals think they're the smartest one in the room and they're not going to get caught. They all think that.
Sure.
That's not special.
Yeah, that's why it's been proven the death penalty doesn't work, because it's not a deterrent for people to not commit crimes, because they don't think about, oh, I'm never going to get caught, so therefore I don't have to worry about getting shot at a firing squad.
Mr. Robinson, I also wish to inform you of your rights against self-incrimination. Anything that you say in court today could be used against you, and we want to protect your constitutional rights. Mr. Robinson, at this time, you will remain in custody without bail.
Robinson's mother expressed concern to her husband that the suspect shooter looked like Robinson. Robinson's father agreed. Robinson's mother explained that over the last year or so, Robinson had become more political and had started to lean more to the left.
As if somehow being left-wing means that you're going to gun somebody down at long range. I think the significance of the mom saying the alleged shooter had become more political and left-leaning was it was a departure from the family values and what he had been his whole life up until that point. Now, we heard last night that a relative of the roommate blames the roommate for radicalizing the defendant. But the reality is it doesn't matter who persuaded him. It doesn't matter. He did this shooting of his own volition. Many people have wondered, did his parents know of his relationship with his male roommate? Yes, they did. Listen.
She stated that Robinson began to date his roommate, a biological male who was transitioning genders. This resulted in several discussions with family members, but especially between Robinson and his father, who have very different political views. In one conversation before the shooting, Robinson mentioned that Charlie Kirk would be holding an event at UVU, which Robinson said was a stupid venue for the event. Robinson accused Kirk of spreading hate.
I'm not quite sure how a murder of a loving father of two, a husband, has turned into an argument about furries and trans. Sydney Sumner joining me, Crime Stories investigative reporter. None of that matters. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if he's straight, if he was gay, if he was bi, if he was trans. None of that bears on the elements of proving a murder case. How did that take center stage, Sid?
Well, some interesting bullet engravings. And we're learning more about those. So at first, we maybe thought that this was a reference that Robinson was a furry, was part of one of these counterculture groups, but it seems like now, based on his text to his boyfriend, that Robinson was just making a giant joke. So his references to the furry group, notices bulge, UWU, ooh-woo, it was just a joke, and it didn't mean anything. So that's why this took such a big part of this, was we thought that he was making some kind of statement with these bullet inscriptions.
Are you saying the inscriptions on the bullet were just a joke, Sydney Sumner?
According to Robinson, that's what he told his roommate.
Sydney, the engravings that you are suggesting are just a joke were on the bullets used to murder an innocent person. So I don't know who's claiming, you know, that's a joke. Listen.
Remember how I was engraving bullets? The messages are mostly a big meme. If I see notices bulge UWU on Fox News, I might have a stroke. All right, I'm going to have to leave it. That really sucks. Judging from today, I'd say Grandpa's gun does just fine. I don't know. I think that was a $2,000 scope. Delete this exchange.
So this is an exchange that the alleged shooter, the Kirk shooter, is having with the romantic partner, as the roommate is being described. Okay. Remember how I was engraving the bullets? Whoa, wait a minute. Number one, what psycho engraves the bullets? I guess this guy, Luigi Mangione. But that says to me, Randolph Rice, the roommate was there when Robinson was engraving the bullets. Hello, accomplice, co-defendant.
The problem, Nancy, they need that roommate in their case because that roommate is so important to connecting the Kirk killer, the Kirk shooter, to those text messages. They need to keep that roommate, that love interest, happy. They need to keep them close because that's going to be probably one of their first witnesses. So I hear what you're saying.
Randolph, the two are not mutually exclusive. You can get his testimony and charge him as an accomplice to murder at the same time. In fact, let me guess, does your wife do all the cooking in the home? Have you ever heard of meat tenderizer? I would let the roommate have a few months behind bars to see if that jogs his recollection. So he can be a co-defendant and a witness at the same time. What about that thought?
He can, but remember, you've got to put this in front of a jury. And how does the jury see that? Because if under your scenario, if you put him in jail and all of a sudden the defense attorney says, hey, you've been sitting in jail, the prosecutor put you there, so you feel like you're forced to tell this story, that doesn't look good in front of the jury.
No. You can argue that till you're blue in the face, Randolph Rice. The fact that he would be arrested as a co-defendant, and again, everyone is presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. That said, of course, a co-defendant goes to jail. That's not unique. That said, what do you make of that text? My original question before you went off with your pity party about the roommate going to jail. That shows me that he was there, the roommate was there, and would recall the defendant engraving bullets. And don't you imagine him go, hi, Tyler Robinson, why are you engraving bullets? I would. So are you telling me now he had no idea what was happening?
No, I think you're right. He did have a knowledge of what was going on. And I think that there's a potential that the roommate gets charged. And you're exactly right on that. I'm looking at it from an optical perspective, but if you wanted to charge the roommate, I think you certainly have that ability to charge them with knowing what was going on beforehand. The problem becomes, can you charge them what happened after? And then the text messages, that becomes another sort of sticky situation.
I'm just trying to figure out what you have to do, Chris McDonough, to actually engrave a bullet. It sounds like trying to thread three needles at once. How do you engrave a bullet?
Well, there's a couple of ways of doing it, Nancy. You can use, a handheld engraver. But let's also take a hard look at the messaging here.
Like you just happen to have a handheld engraver in your tool pocket? Who would have a handheld engraver? You know what? Step back and punt. You have anything else for me?
Yeah, you can buy that really simple at Home Depot, but also recognize that he says mostly the effing messages were mostly a big mean, i.e. there's another messaging in the showcasing or the cartridges that were recovered. They only recovered, they didn't find any showcasing on the roof. So that means A, it was either left in the bolt of the weapon, and then the three in the magazine. So the fact that he was engraving a message on those cartridges tells us there's a bigger story.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Okay, I know you want to know. Robinson ordered a large, medium rare sirloin, vegetables on the side, and a baked potato. Mm-hmm. Apparently, committing murder did not affect his appetite. The Charlie Kirk shooting caused shockwaves across our country. This is what happened. If you don't happen to be one of those people that have a home hand engraver, then how would you do it? With a knife? How do you do that? And it's got to be legible because these were easily read.
Yeah, it does have to be legible. And the fact from this struck me from the beginning, because we've had a couple, if you remember the Minneapolis shooting at Mass a few weeks ago, that individual wrote these kind of cryptic messages on the magazines themselves, but that was with a marker, like an ink marker. In this case, you have to get something that is, I think I mentioned maybe yesterday in the morgue, we use what are referred to as diamond engravers to mark the bases of bullets. And this works on a metallic surface as well. You have electrical engravers. I don't know if he went that far. And the problem is
we don't know. Wait, I was about to mock you about the diamond engraver, but wait a minute. Yeah. Didn't he work as an electrician or as an electrician's welder?
Yeah.
So he may have that tool.
He very well might, or he could have some semblance of that. That would be what you have is a metallic body that will mark on brass, because this is brass. It's one of the softest metals that's out there. And people do engrave. Soldiers have been doing it for years and years. I wonder where you got this idea from. But you know what I'm more interested in, Nancy? Not just the engraving. I'm fascinated by the fact that this guy, according to the presser, not only left engravings to mark these rounds, but he also left his DNA on specific components within the weapon, even the trigger, Nancy. This guy's leaving signatures everywhere.
When you say within the weapon, you're right. Where did authorities find DNA, and they found a lot of it?
Yeah, I'm thinking, well, first off, they mentioned specifically the trigger housing. And I say housing actually on the surface of the trigger. So that's probably going to be touch DNA where you're pulling the trigger. However, this weapon has what's referred to as an internal magazine. It's not like the classic magazine. It kind of drops out and you have to feed it back in. You literally, Nancy, have to take your thumb and press these rounds into that indwelling magazine. So any of those surfaces around there where you're trying to leverage this thing, even on the surface of the bolt, the handle of the bolt, any of these areas, you can deposit DNA. And let's face it, he had this thing wrapped in a towel. He's got this thing in kind of a pristine condition he's left it in. So, they had a field day when they got their hands on this thing in the lab.
Police interview Robinson's roommate, a biological male who was involved in a romantic relationship with Robinson. The roommate told police that the roommate received messages from Robinson about the shooting, and he did provide those messages to police.
I can get close to it, but there's a squad car parked right by it. I think they already swept that spot, but I don't want to chance it. I'm wishing I had circled back and grabbed it as soon as I got to my vehicle. I'm worried what my old man would do if I didn't bring back Grandpa's rifle. I don't even know if it had a serial number, but it wouldn't trace to me. I worry about prints. I had to leave it in a bush where I changed outfits. Didn't have the ability or time to bring it with. I might have to abandon it and hope they don't find prints. How the f*** will I explain losing it to my old man?
I think he needs to get his priorities straight. He's worried about his dad being mad. He lost the grandpa's gun. What about the death penalty? What is he thinking, Dr. Bethany Marshall? And did you notice? This is a recreate of all of the texts the alleged shooter sends to the roommate. If you notice, roommate's not answering. He's like, what? But the guy's worried about losing grandpa's gun?
Nancy, I'd love to talk about the idea that he thinks that what's on the bullets are a meme. A meme is a joke. So he's already minimizing the severity of the alleged crime. A meme is something that goes viral and everybody sees it. So there's this fantasy of being famous, like being some kind of a hero. The reference to the bulge, I take all of this seriously. None of it is a joke. The bulge is getting an erection while you are shooting somebody. If he were my patient, I would ask him, what is sexually exciting about shooting somebody and whizzing the bullet over a crowd of family and children? Is it that sadism is exciting? Having power over people is exciting? I'd want to try to get to the root of that to understand this guy's mind.
You know what? There's so much happening in this case. Remember the old guy at the get-go that claims he was responsible for the shooting? I did it, raising both hands. Now saying that he was just trying to give the real shooter a chance to get away? Okay, listen to what the alleged shooter says about that.
I thought they caught the person?
No, they grabbed some crazy old dude that interrogated someone in similar clothing. I had planned to grab my rifle from my drop point shortly after, but most of that side of town got locked down. It's quiet, almost enough to get out, but there's one vehicle lingering.
Why?
Why did I do it?
Yeah.
I had enough of his hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out. If I am able to grab my rifle unseen, I will have left no evidence. Going to attempt to retrieve it again. Hopefully they have moved on. I haven't seen anything about them finding it.
How long have you been planning this?
A bit over a week, I believe.
So much for the insanity defense. He had this thing planned out cold. But my point is, George Zinn, the one that threw investigators off at the beginning, claiming he did it. He was arrested. Now everybody's trashing the FBI director for arresting him. He said he did it. Well, there's a sad sack right there. Okay, bombshell Hermonia Rodriguez. George Zinn has caught a few charges himself, hasn't he?
Yeah, this has been another incredible part of the story. As you said, right after the shooting, this man was filmed saying, I shot him. Now, apparently, he has told police that he wanted to give the actual shooter time to get away. We have learned that he is someone who has previously caused trouble in the area, and he's now charged with child pornography.
That just trilled off your tongue. Did you just say child pornography?
Correct. After he was taken into custody right after this shooting, days later, he has been charged with this crime.
So, Mr. Robinson, you have a right to an attorney. If you cannot afford one, the court can appoint an attorney to represent you. I have reviewed your declaration of financial status and find that you are indigent. I'm provisionally appointing a Rule 8 qualified attorney to represent you on your case, Mr. Robinson. Along with their filing of their appearance of counsel, the assigned attorneys must file declarations with the court that outline their qualifications under Rule 8 and Rule 8C under Rule 8B and Rule 8C for counsel appointment in a case where death may be a sentencing option.
When the photo of the shooter was released, disseminated to the public, the server at the restaurant was certain that was the same person that ate at the mom and pop the night of the shootings, and it was immediately turned over to the FBI. The restaurant owner and two employees were questioned by federal agents. Digits of the credit card used to pay for this steak fest were handed over to the FBI. So a 31-year-old married father of two gunned down dead at the Utah Valley University, and he's having a steak dinner. Robinson now facing seven felony charges of aggravated murder, discharge of a firearm causing serious bodily injury, obstruction of justice, two counts witness tampering, and commission of a violent offense in the presence of a child. Robbins behind bars, awaiting trial. He could face the death penalty by firing squad if convicted. Utah is one of the five states that still allow the firing squad. We wait as justice unfolds. Nancy Gray signing off. Goodbye, friend.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.